Welcome to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm your host, Richard Nelson. Well, Thanksgiving is upon us, where most of us will gather together around the dinner table and eat turkey and pumpkin pie, watch football, and enjoy time with family. But what is it that we're actually celebrating? Is it just food and family, or is it something deeper? We learned in grade school that the Pilgrims came here from England, and after a long, hard winter, they invited the Indians for some kind of a celebration that we celebrate and remember as our first Thanksgiving. But is our history accurate? There's much revisionism going on regarding the Pilgrims and also God's role in the establishment of the American colonies. That'd be a good program to invite Dr. Thomas Kidd, who's a professor of church history at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. He also teaches American history. He's the author of numerous books, including his most recent, called Thomas Jefferson, Biography of Spirit and Flesh. Dr. Kidd has written for media outlets like the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. And he also blogs on evangelical history at the Gospel Coalition website. Dr. Kidd, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters.
Thanks for having me.
So back in 2013, you wrote a column that caught my attention in Christianity Today. It was entitled, This Thanksgiving, Stop Idolizing the Pilgrims. An evangelical historian teaches us how to think critically about the heroes of the past. Now, one reason I start out with this is because we do have a tendency to idolize some of the historical figures, whether they're American presidents or figures like the Pilgrims. And you're approaching this not as a revisionist, but as a Christian historian or as a historian who happens to be a Christian. And you want us to have an accurate understanding of the Pilgrims and of our history. What prompted you to write this in the first place?
Right. Well, Christianity Today asked me to write this piece about the first Thanksgiving and the Pilgrims interacting with a book by Tracy McKenzie about the first Thanksgiving and more generally. There's just a sense, I think, that we have a really hard time knowing how to talk about people in the past and our culture now, because, you know, on one hand, you have this sort of cancel culture impulse where if you can discover any way in what somebody in the past doesn't live up to kind of contemporary, usually secular liberal mores, they're irredeemable and we can't talk about them anymore and they have to be canceled. And then I think that there's a sort of conservative and Christian backlash against that that gets very defensive and says, no, you know, we won't put up with any kind of negative talk about the people we admire in history. And you know, as Christians, we know that everybody is imperfect. Everybody is sinful. So as much as we admire people, we can't go to the other extreme and just say, oh, well, these people were perfect and are not subject to criticism. And so that kind of leaves us at an impasse with people like the Pilgrims, who were clearly courageous, and champions of what we now would call religious liberty. But it's not as if they were perfect people. They had flaws and we need to be willing to talk about that. So in a way, it's just kind of exploring that problem that we have, especially from a Christian perspective, about how to, you know, given the state of our culture now, how do we talk about people in the past that we really admire?
Now, you wrote that column before really cancel culture came on the scene. I'd say cancel culture really has taken full form just in the last few years since COVID. It seems that there is a more active effort to cancel those out, those opinions that don't align with mainstream secular values. You wrote this column about the Pilgrims in 2013. By the way, I want to make clear to our listeners that this is not a program meant to discredit the Pilgrims or to discount any of the good that they did. I think they did amazing things. Just the courage, as you mentioned, Dr. Kidd, to leave their homeland and to come here to set up essentially a Christian commonwealth. If you read the Mayflower Compact, It's very clear that they wanted to do life in a different way apart from the Church of England. But could you expand on that? Let's talk about some of the good, some of the positive, the motivating forces of the Pilgrims. Why did they come?
Sure. Well, the Pilgrims were part of the separatist movement in England, and they were a very small group of Christians in England who believed that the Church of England, which was the official national denomination, was then and it still is today in England, had become really apostate for a variety of reasons. They didn't feel like it was fully reformed. They felt like it was corrupted in all kinds of ways, and so they wanted to start their own churches. Seems pretty simple to us, but in the 1620s in England, that was illegal. You had to get permission from the state to start a church, and there was no tolerance for people who didn't believe in the Church of England. And so, whether you were separatist or a Baptist or even a Catholic or something like that, forget it. You cannot start your own church. And so, in a way, it has almost a feel of like in China, the house churches or something like that, where the separatists just would not cooperate with the mandates of the state about religion. And so they were badly persecuted in the early 1600s in England. They started meeting in illegal, kind of home congregations and suffered terribly under persecution. And so some of them ended up going to the Netherlands across the English Channel in continental Europe. That was a little better because the Netherlands did have at least kind of religious toleration. They weren't going to, drag you out of your house and make you go to the official church. And so that was okay for the separatists. But some of them worried about the corruption of the churches in the Netherlands and the influence of Dutch culture and that sort of thing. And so a group of the English separatists decided ultimately to leave Europe and go to the New World. And that was an attraction for many thousands of people a lot of different kinds of religious groups about that the New World seemed like a kind of a fresh start, that if they had suffered persecution for a variety of reasons in Europe and in Britain, that maybe they could go to the New World and be able to practice their faith and freedom. And freedom in particular from persecution. And so that's what the Plymouth separatists were doing when they showed up in the New World in 1620.
Now, there were two groups that disagreed with what the Church of England was doing. You said, use the word apostasy. They violated a number of orthodox Christian principles. But there was the other group, the Puritans. Tell us the difference between the Pilgrims and the Puritans.
Right. So, if you think about the difference between the Puritans and the separatists, and so the Pilgrims are separatists, and so you can tell by their name what their stance is with regard to the Church of England. So the separatists want to separate from the Church of England entirely, which again is illegal. The Puritans were not quite as radical as the separatists. They thought there were huge problems with the Church of England, but that they still thought it could be purified from within. So as a practical matter, the Puritans said, we are still part of the Church of England, but we need to work on a lot of biblical reform. And so the separatists come to Plymouth in 1620, but a much larger group of Puritans found Massachusetts in 1629 and 30. And so 10 years after the Pilgrims, quote unquote, come to Plymouth, but and so the Puritans tended to think that the separatists were kind of fanatics, right? And so we think, well, all these people were just sort of English Christians and stuff, and they all got along. That absolutely not true. The Puritans kind of thought that the separatists were crazy, but they were motivated by the same type of concerns about the problems in the Church of England.
One of the ironies I see here is that if it was the Puritans who came here first and the Pilgrims came after, the pilgrims wouldn't have had religious freedom to worship according to their conscience. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. The Puritans, I mean, they came for religious freedom in the sense of being able to practice biblical faith and freedom, but they would not extend that freedom to people who did not agree with the Puritans. And so there are only very small groups of Christians, people like Roger Williams, who founded Rhode Island, who was also attracted to separatism. Roger Williams was one of the only people in colonial America who believed that you should just get the state out of religion. And one of the things that groups like the Puritans expected the state in, you know, in Massachusetts to do was to enforce religious orthodoxy. But Williams just thought, no, I mean, let's just get the state out of it because the state corrupts things, which I think he's right about that. And so especially, you know, the church is just too important to let the state run a church. No, that's terrible. And so there are small groups in colonial America who believe in religious liberty in a kind of a modern sense, in the way that most of us think about it. But the Puritans were not interested in tolerating religious disagreement. And so they badly persecuted separatists, but also groups like the Baptists. They would not allow to live in Massachusetts. They would not allow Quakers. They would not allow Catholics. They would not allow Jews. I mean, they in our view, I think it, even in a conservative Christian view today, they would be seen as intolerant
and really creating a two-class society where unless you were part of the Puritan Church, you would not have full citizenship rights. You had to be licensed to teach, and it could only be a Puritan church, a congregational church. You could not vote. You could not hold office. You did not have freedom of conscience. And along these lines, we did a conference back a couple months ago about Christian nationalism, and we were able to unpack some of these ideas. And again, this is not to discount the good things that the Puritans did, the good that they brought here. But this is, there were certainly some warts and blemishes as well that we need to address and carefully think about. Dr. Kidd, let's talk about that first Thanksgiving. I just learned something yesterday as I was putting together notes for this program. You know, the Charlie Brown version or the grade school version says that after that hard winter, where, of course, the Pilgrims lost half of their number within the first year, many of them were lost traveling over the ocean. Many of them didn't make it through that hard winter. They ended up burying many of their people here. We think of Plymouth, first place that they stopped, but it's really not true. They stopped. They first landed at Cape Cod. The Indians didn't welcome them there. They pulled up their anchor, got back in the ship, and then they went to Plymouth ultimately. And they, we think of the Indians coming to help them, show them how to plant corn and how to live off the land. And then we hear that the Pilgrims invited the Indians, but that really wasn't the case. Actually, the Pilgrims were having a celebration. They were shooting their guns in celebration, and the Indians, the local Indians, as I understand, as I learned yesterday, thought there was some kind of a war breaking out. So Massasoit, with 90 of his warriors, came, and they were prepared for some kind of a battle. Is that your understanding?
The records that we have of what happened in 1621 are just very spotty. I mean, and so we know that there was some sort of meal that they had with local Indians led by Massasoit, and there had been some, you know, diplomatic overtures between the local Indians and the Plymouth colonists. But as you said, I mean, that first winter, you know, in the Charlie Brown version, I mean, it's easy to underestimate how harrowing that first winter was. And it wasn't a large group anyway, but half of them died. And that's part, I mean, it's not to criticize them, but it's so often the case that the early colonists just simply did not know what they were getting into. And it's a horrible thing to think about them. I mean, so many of them died before they even got off the ship. There's starvation. It's just a terrible, terrible situation that they're in. And so I think that puts a different gloss on what Thanksgiving means for them is that they've sacrificed so much to come to the new world, and then they see half of their company die within a year. And so it's a harvest festival, and they have gotten some help from local Native Americans about how best to grow crops in Plymouth. We can fill in some of the details about, you know, what they must have felt and what this was like. But it's a grim occasion as much as a celebration of just thank God that some of us are still alive. And they are undoubtedly thankful for the help that they got from Native Americans. But it's in a minor chord, I think, more than just sort of quaint celebrations and the incredible material abundance that we enjoy today is nothing like what they experienced. They're just trying to survive.
Right. And of course, the Indians did bring deer. The records indicate that they brought five deer to the celebration. The Indians did have turkey. Many of the other foods that they had were not like what we have today. I understand they had shellfish. You know, they weren't. Probably didn't put stuffing inside the turkey. They didn't think they were making pumpkin pies, that kind of thing.
No, there were no pies. And we think that they almost certainly ate eel. they did seem to have turkey, though. I mean, at least there's that. That makes it recognizable. But otherwise, it's just what they had around. It was not this kind of go to the grocery store in abundance that we enjoy today.
If you are enjoying this podcast, then please go to your favorite podcast platform and rate us. This is one of the ways that you can help our podcast audience grow. Also, please tell a friend about us. You can share the Commonwealth Matters on your social media platforms as well. Thanks again for listening to the Commonwealth Matters.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson talking with Dr. Thomas Kidd about the Pilgrims and Thanksgiving. Dr. Kidd, how did the original Thanksgiving celebration turn into a modern holiday? I know it was celebrated by the Pilgrims early on, but then there were lapses where it was not celebrated every year. It was not a national holiday. How did it become a modern holiday?
Well, so Thanksgiving as a observance is really an older Christian tradition that predates 1620. It was just normal, especially in a situation where you had a state church, for the government and the churches to announce that we're going to set aside a certain day as a day of Thanksgiving. But it wasn't necessarily the same time every year. It was more just if say there's a great victory in a battle or something like that, that they believed that they were accountable to God for, you know, all good things that happened and their fate as a people, so that they would just regularly have Thanksgiving services. And so that is what 1621 was, is just an occasional Thanksgiving service. But they would also have days of prayer and fasting. Sometimes they called them days of prayer, fasting, and humiliation. If you can imagine, you know, the government saying we need to have a day of prayer, fasting, and humiliation before God. In other words, everybody was familiar with the idea of having a day of Thanksgiving. It just wasn't like a national holiday, like you said. And so the colonies would do that. Britain would do that. And then, of course, everything changes with the Revolution, but the Continental Congress was regularly declaring days of Thanksgiving or prayer and fasting. And so when George Washington becomes president in the 1780s, it's just as natural as it can be that his administration would declare days of Thanksgiving. And so they began that practice right away in 1789, and that Thanksgiving happened to be in November that Washington proclaimed. But that, I think, is when you start to have the attachment to November And it is a natural time because of the kind of the end of the harvest and moving into winter. It's a natural seasonal time to have it.
Was this based on the historical context of the pilgrims, or was this based on maybe he had some ideas of where the state could act in somewhat of a religious capacity? We do know that he called upon God. He did attend church. But where did he get this idea to have a proclamation calling for prayer and fasting and even a proclamation of thanksgiving?
Sure. Well, I mean, people like Washington were entirely familiar with the practice of calling for days of thanksgiving or days of prayer and fasting. And so he wouldn't have needed to call on the memory of the pilgrims, because it was, I mean, there were much more recent precedents, and the Continental Congress was doing that during the Revolution. And this is just what governments did at the time in Britain and America. So what would have been strange is for Washington not to do it, that he literally would have been breaking precedent to not do this. And there was no sense at the time of that this somehow would be inappropriate for the government to do a day of thanksgiving to God. I mean, this is just what governments at the time did. And so it was very smooth for Washington to declare a day of national thanksgiving. And so from time to time, the national government in the United States after the Revolution would do this. You know, Jefferson was an outlier in the sense that he was very hesitant about having the national government call for days of prayer in particular. He thought that was a violation of the First Amendment's prohibition on establishments of religion. But basically, all the other presidents in the 1700s and 1800s, you know, just didn't agree with Jefferson. And so it became a regular practice during the Civil War to have a Thanksgiving national holiday in November. And so it was observed every year from then on. And then I think during the 1940s, it was made an annual national holiday that didn't have to be proclaimed every year.
Let's look at, I'm going to go back to the pilgrims and what motivated them to come here. They sought religious freedom. They were being persecuted from England. They wanted to set up, if you will, a Christian commonwealth. I think that's what the Mayflower Compact clearly says. What are some of the common myths about the pilgrims?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that one is just, I think we tend to think of them as the first colonists, so, which is just completely wrong. So, you know, the first enduring English settlement in America is Virginia in 1607. So precedes Plymouth by 13 years. I think that the reason we give so much attention to Plymouth is because of Thanksgiving. But I think a lot of Americans would think, oh, well, somehow they were like the first or something. But that's not true. That they were a very, very small group, especially as compared to the Massachusetts colonists, and have ultimately Massachusetts absorbs the Plymouth colony. So the Plymouth colony doesn't even last as an enduring colony. So, I mean, I'm all for their symbolic importance, but in terms of the broader spectrum of English colonists in America, I think we can say they're not that important. But you know, I mean, it's so hard to get Americans to think about anything historical ever. I think that the connection to Thanksgiving is a good reason to focus on the Plymouth colonists, and it really is important in the sense of the precedent for religious liberty. I mean, because the Virginia colonists are overwhelmingly Christian and everything, but they didn't come to Virginia for religious liberty in the way that the Plymouth separatists did. And so for those of us who value that tradition of religious liberty, I really do think that the Plymouth separatists are awfully important.
I want to talk about, if I could, the importance of understanding our history people that doesn't understand their history, doesn't know where they came from, or I would say where they're going. As Christians in particular, we should understand our history and really how we can see God's hand in history. Dr. Kidd, you wrote another column at Christianity Today called Five Ways We Misunderstand American Religious History. As Christians, we should be people of truth. We should care about the past, and we should care about telling the truth as we in the present and looking forward. What are some potential dangers or even opportunities for Christians when we study the religious history of America, including events like Thanksgiving and including people like the Pilgrims?
Yeah, I mean, I think we tend to go to one extreme or the other of just trashing people in the past, which seems to be the specialty of a lot of secular liberals today, and sort of establishing our own like virtue by condemning people in the past. It's a very strange kind of virtue, but that's what people seem to like to do these days. But on kind of my side as a conservative Christian, I mean, I think our problem is making people out to be more than what really we know theologically people can ever be. I mean, everybody except for a certain carpenter's son from Nazareth, I mean, is imperfect, flawed, and sinful. And so subject to the same kind of limitations and struggles that I am. And so I think that, you know, we have to be willing to talk about that and be honest about that. I think we always have to be open to seeing the tragedy and the errors and sins even of people in the past, and leading to, I hope, humility on our part of not triumphalism about how much better we are allegedly than people in the past, but just humility about the sad record of human history and violence that's just marked by sin.
Very well said. You'd mentioned that we see people today trash those historical characters when they find a flaw or they find terrible, egregious sin. They trash them. And I'm wondering how, as Christians, we can look at our historical figures who had some virtue, courage, deep religious convictions, and yet very flawed and did some, as you just shared, some terrible things. I guess I'm answering my own question. We look at our own fallenness, our own sin, and realize that none of us are perfect. Dr. Thomas Kidd, it has been a pleasure having you on this program. If anybody would like to get your recent book, Thomas Jefferson, A Biography of Spirit and Flesh, how would they find that?
Well, they can certainly order it at Amazon, and if your local bookstore doesn't have it on the shelf, they can always order it for you as well.
Dr. Thomas Kidd, thank you again for joining us on The Commonwealth Matters. Thank you again for listening. May God bless you, and enjoy your Thanksgiving.